I did a piece for The Voice critiquing a CBS News special back in 1975, or 76, I guess. And I noted that the CBS programs that they did then and in 1967 when they did their first series of specials were almost identical. Then back in 67, up until the last minute, most of the producers anticipated a script that would raise grave doubts about whether Oswald had acted alone. And then all of a sudden, overnight, something changed. And CBS backed the Warren Commission right down the line. One producer named Bob Richter was so astounded that he resigned. When they did it again in 76, same story. Now, you may have noticed over the years that when a book comes out, like Case Closed by Gerald Posner, or more recently, Vincent Bugliosi's tome regurgitating the Warren Commission and basically saying they were right, those books get widely reviewed by the New York Times and others. I don't remember one conspiracy book that's been reviewed by a major newspaper in many, many years. This is despite the fact that way back on November 22, 1963, the very first dispatch that came out with the AP reported the shots apparently came from a grassy knoll in the area, which many of you probably realize some of them, or at least one of them, did. Time Life buys the Zapruder film, the famous Zapruder film, right away for $150,000, a huge sum in those days, and then they keep it out of the public domain until the mid-1970s. Nobody can see it. And they're saying that they hold on to all rights. The publisher says it would just be too painful to see this this film. Well, the publisher of Life magazine at that time was a guy named C.D. Jackson. And in 1977, Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame, which kind of ignited this investigative reporting possibilities in the 1970s for a while, came out with a piece in Rolling Stone about the CIA and the media. And in that piece, he described how for many years, C.D. Jackson, who was the publisher of Life magazine from 1960 until he died in 64, had been the key guy working on behalf of Time for the CIA. He had been approving their specific arrangements for providing CIA employees with Time Life cover. And this was the guy who held onto the Zapruder film, would not let it be seen. Of course, the media right away is coming out and saying that Oswald was the lone assassin. Life comes out with a report about the Warren Report, and it's illustrating this with the Zapruder film in 1967, again, I think it was. And one of the frames contradicts the Warren Report and contradicts the lone assassin finding. They take that magazine issue back, and they completely redo the plates. I mean, when this was discovered, to their horror, that this was going to show that things were not as they seemed, they redid the magazine completely, took it off the newsstands. They did a big series in 67, and Richard Billings, who was an editor then at the time, he said, it's not Life's function to investigate the Kennedy assassination. Well, it comes out as the years go by. The Bernstein piece in 77, and finally the New York Times even has to do a series on the press and the media and the CIA, that Time Life, CBS News, William Paley, and the New York Times have all signed these agreements with the CIA and providing cover for maybe 400 CIA people all over the world. Now, in those days, of course, the CIA and it wasn't considered this evil thing that necessarily by most people. This was, part of, they all grew up together, they went to the same schools, so it's not terribly surprising. But then you had people like Hal Hendricks, who worked for the Miami News, who gets a Pulitzer Prize for releasing the first stories on the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's also the one who puts out the first stuff about Oswald being this left-wing nut who worked for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. I mean, it's really a pretty endless series of stuff, and I won't go into all of it here. We could maybe get into some of it later, but earlier Bill Pepper alluded to the civil trial of Martin Luther King that he initiated not too long ago in the 90s. You know, the jury came out and concluded that there had been a conspiracy to kill King by a series of people. Well, what gets the TV coverage? The O.J. Simpson trial. You never heard a thing about this King civil trial. Now, during the Iran-Contra era, as Craig Unger mentioned, I mean, Reagan should have been impeached for his role in trading arms for hostages, but the media would not look at this. And, of course, this was the time corporations began buying up the big media, and then you had this guy Gary Webb, who worked for the San Jose Mercury News and broke this incredible story about the crack epidemic in L.A. being tied to CIA drug money that was being used to fund the Contras. And Gary Webb was vilified by the big media. Even
first celebrated.
First, very briefly.
With a Pulitzer Prize, Didn't he win the Pulitzer?
No, he did not. I don't think Gary Webb got the Pulitzer.
Huh.
He won something, and then the big media just went after him. He ended up committing suicide or being killed. Most likely he was killed because otherwise he would have had to shoot himself twice in the head.
Two gunshot wounds to the head.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. And then you get to 2000 and 2004, and a subject Mark knows a great deal about, and we could talk about more as we go on, which is that, you know, the Bush administration steals two elections. The first one, there was a CBS News analysis done. You remember on election night in 2000, it was a guy with Fox News who was a cousin of the Bushes. Fox News breaks it first, and there's a famous thing about this guy getting up on, standing up in the Fox News room that night saying, Jebby, meaning Jeb Bush, Jebby says we got it, Jebby says we got it. So Fox calls it for Florida. What they don't reveal, and nobody talks about until later, of course, is the fact that there was already a fraudulent computer glitch that switched votes from Gore to Bush. CBS News later does this internal analysis, and I'll just quote one thing from it, which is that, you know, they talk about how the vote reports were skewed, and had it not been for these errors, the CBS News call for Bush at 2:17 a.m. would not have been made. So that was the first stolen election. They took it with or without the Supreme Court. And then in 2004, I did a couple of pieces, one piece particularly with Bobby Kennedy Jr. on the voting machines. And that was just absolutely blatant. I mean, what they did in Ohio. They set up a mirror website out in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where you could switch the votes. I mean, incredible story that all the big media should have been all over. And a guy named Mike Connell, who was getting ready to blow the whistle on all this in 2008, was just starting to talk. He'd been involved in setting up all this stuff for the Bush administration in Ohio. Suddenly his private plane goes down in Akron shortly after the election in 2008. So he's out of the picture and can't tell us anymore what happened.
And we conclude with Professor Peter Dale Scott being interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner for Guns and Butter from March 2014. I'm sorry the audio quality doesn't somehow seem to be completely up to scratch, and I hope it doesn't mar your understanding of the important points being made.
In your book, American War Machine, you state that, quote, a major thesis of this book is that the numerous authors who have written about a shadow government in the United States have usually neglected or underrepresented the role of the global drug connection in its development, meaning, of course, the shadow government. Yeah. Would you say that the emphasis in your research on the global drug connection is what separates you somewhat from other writers who deal with what you have termed the deep state?
I think not all of them. Two authors leap out as doing the same sort of thing. One would be, of course, Alfred McCoy. His first book on drugs and my first book mentioning drugs came out in the same year, but his book is almost like the Bible in the field. And I am more critical, perhaps, of the CIA and the drug traffic than he is, but his criticisms have had real weight in the country and led to, you know, congressional investigations and so on. And the other man is a co-author of mine, Jonathan Marshall. He and I did Cocaine Politics together. But there's not a lot of people in this field. Oh, Douglas Valentine. I'll probably remember some more after this show is over. But no, there are not many. That's the main point.
You write that the continuous U.S. involvement in the global drug connection is a destructive pattern that persists to this day. Just how dangerous is the drug trade? You write that the global traffic in drugs is a threat to democratic institutions and to democracy itself. How so?
Well, starting in the third world, if you get a local drug traffic, you get people to protect it, to enforce it, the thugs who become organized. And this is from the point of view of the CIA is very useful because you can then recruit those people for your purposes. And that's what I write about in Southeast Asia, Thailand and Laos particularly, and then later, of course, Afghanistan. But it's led to a top-heavy, you know, the problem of the deep state in America is also a problem. We've had the CIA for over 60 years has been able to rely on funds that are not in its budget to conduct its own operations. So in an extreme case, we had the CIA fighting a war in Laos with an army of 35,000 troops. was not authorized by Congress. It was not a democratic policy. It was one which had dire consequences because it turned the Golden Triangle into the major source of opium and heroin worldwide, which was a scourge. And look what it did to our inner cities, and is still doing to our inner cities. And my analysis of how we got so involved in Vietnam is that to a large extent, it was something which proceeded logically out of what we were already doing in Laos, and that proceeded logically out of what we are already doing in Thailand, and all of this was using forces who were financed by the drug traffic, and Congress had no say in the matter, didn't know about it, and even large sections of the executive didn't know about it, and many of those who did know about it opposed it, but it went ahead anyway. So, yes, I think it was a terrible thing, both abroad and at home. And in my book, well, even more in another book, Drugs, Oil, and War, the experience of all this in Southeast Asia was then replicated in Latin America, only there the supporting drug was cocaine. And I'm very proud of the fact that in, I think it was back in 1990, that George H.W. Bush had announced a war on drugs in Colombia, the Andean campaign, and I predicted in 1990, I said, if we fight a war on drugs in Colombia, the result is going to be more cocaine coming to this country, not less. And within 10 years, the amount of cocaine being grown in Colombia had trebled, which I attribute directly to the fact that planes were flying in and out, putting arms and troops in remote places exactly where the cocaine was being grown. And so out came the cocaine. In fact, they even indicted one of the people who was in an American colonel or somebody in the war on drugs in Colombia, was then eventually, I think, convicted for drug trafficking. But that's the tip of the iceberg. It wasn't one individual. It's this whole industry, this whole infrastructure of planes going in and out. And that's why Afghanistan also, once we started backing people there, was transformed into the source of 90% of the world's heroin, replacing the Golden Triangle, where we were no longer active as we had been before.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the war on drugs itself led to an explosion in drug trafficking. Do you think that's the case?
Well, that's a very oversimplified but essentially true, I think, account of what has happened. It's conceded. You know, it was Nixon originally started the war on drugs back in 1970, and more drugs are consumed here now than before. Well, a lot of people believe that if we would end the war on drugs, that drug consumption would go down. Because if you fight a war on drugs, that makes drug trafficking more profitable. It drives the price up. More people come in to cash in on this. And conversely, I think, we're beginning to see now an easing off in the case of marijuana. And Mexico, you know, the worst era in the whole drug situation for Mexico has been in the last decade, whereas tens of thousands have died in drug wars. And although some of that profit is in cocaine, most of it is from marijuana. So let everybody grow his own little plant, and you would get rid of something which is a social scourge in the sense of crime, prostitution, people shooting each other. All of this, I would say, you could say, is a consequence of the war on drugs. The scale that it's at is a consequence.
Did the U.S. Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II have anything to do with Operation Gladio, the stay-behinds, who staged false flag terror targeted to incriminate leftists in Europe? And if so, where was the funding for Gladio coming from? Was the CIA skimming money from the Marshall Plan?
The Marshall Plan was, I didn't say this in American War Machine because I didn't know it then. I don't know that it was known at all publicly, but we now know that the legislation establishing the Marshall Plan had a secret codicil in it, which perhaps most of the legislators weren't aware of, that a significant slice, maybe 10% or so, of Marshall Plan funds were in fact to be for covert operations in Europe. I can't prove that it went directly to Gladio. I think we can separate, we can talk about Gladio later. But for all CIA operations in Europe, for some years, it was regularly, they sent up something called the Economic Cooperation Administration, ECA. ECA administered the Marshall Plan funds, and some of the people in ECA were CIA, and I think actually Bissell, Richard Bissell, came back from ECA, joined the CIA, and moved right up to the top of DDP and ran the Bay of Pigs. So that the Marshall Plan was a way of funding covert operations. And what this means is that, you know, I've been thinking about this in terms of the deep state. The CIA is supposed to be part of the system of checks and balances of the state, because Congress is supposed to have the power of the purse. And that means that maybe only a small group of people in Congress, those who are cleared at the highest level, can see what programs are being authorized and what not. But the CIA isn't dependent, never has been dependent on funds from Congress. It has always had access to funds from abroad, even before the Marshall Plan. The very first CIA operation of any consequence was in Italy in 1948, the Italian election. They were worried the communists were going to win, and very well the communists might have won if it hadn't been for, I think it was $10 million, of, at least $10 million of money came from the CIA, but it wasn't congressionally authorized money. It was captured Axis funds, which had never been turned in to anybody's treasury, but were just kept by intelligence agencies. It wasn't a CIA, of course, at the time the funds were captured, but when the CIA was finally created in 1947, they had access to these funds, and then they had access to the Marshall Plan funds. And you can carry this right down to the present day. They have always had access to funds not voted by Congress. And instead of Congress controlling the CIA, it is very much the reverse, because some of those funds, well, let's take profits from the drug trade, for example. The drug trade became very big in Thailand, thanks to the Thai police, who were essentially created and supported and armed and trained and everything by the CIA. And you had enormous profits in Thailand in the 1950s from the drug trade. And some of those profits were channeled to a man called Paul Helliwell in Miami. And he was a lawyer, and he had the title of being His Thai Majesty's consul in Miami. He was also the man who would set up the infrastructure for the CIA for the armies in Southeast Asia who were trafficking drugs. And he would then distribute the funds. Some of it went to Democrats, some of it went to Republicans. But profits from the drug trade were going to members of Congress, and they didn't even know it was drug profits. They just thought of it as not money from Thailand, so it was somewhat cleaned up or laundered by the time it reached them. But you see the difference in the balance of power. In a democracy, Congress should be controlling the CIA. But there have always been these funds coming from abroad, from projects connected to CIA operations, which have corrupted both Congress and the executive. And that's why it's important to recognize we have a deep state in this country.
Peter, even if the funding, a lot of the funding for black ops was coming from drug trafficking and abroad, where the funding may not have been authorized by Congress, the black ops themselves, even though maybe not publicly, they were still sanctioned by the government, right?
They were sanctioned by the people in these agencies. I don't know who sanctioned Gladio. I don't know them. By the way, I separated off Gladio because I'm not sure it was entirely a CIA operation. I think there was an input also from the Department of Defense. So there had to have been, I think, people in both the Pentagon and the CIA who authorized these things. I don't have great depth on the question of Gladio. I don't know if we know there was ever presidential authorization for it or not. Daniel Gasser, in his book on Gladio, believes, and he has a lot of support for it, that a lot of the direction came from the NATO headquarters in Brussels. Well, the head of NATO in Brussels is always an American. A lot of important people like Alexander Haig and so on. You either start in being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, like General Lemnitzer, and then go to NATO, or the other way around. You do a stint at the head of, as the head of NATO, and then you come in to be like Haig, the Secretary of State under Reagan. But the fact that these things are being authorized by Americans in Brussels doesn't necessarily mean that Washington is telling Brussels what to do, I think. This is a dark area where I don't know enough to say things with confidence, but the reason I want to talk about a deep state is to suggest that there is a zone of government which is not under the secure control of the public state and which is in a position to influence and shape the policies of the public state. And I would suspect, though I can't prove it, that Gladio might be an example of that, because Gladio had huge consequences, particularly in Italy and Belgium and Turkey, but Norway, other countries, it was a very widespread program, and obviously it was American in its conception and origin.
Now, you mentioned Paul Helliwell. According to your book, he was part of the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, the Office of Policy Coordination, the OPC.
Right, which I put a lot of emphasis on because most people weren't aware of it. But the CIA wasn't really in covert operations in the early years. It was OPC that was set up to handle covert operations, and it was wildly out of control. And it was recognized to be out of control. So the idea was, well, we'll control it. We'll put it in the CIA. And that happened in 1952. And they needed somebody to oversee that. And that was Alan Dulles before he went on to be the director of Central Intelligence. And instead of the CIA being able to control the OPC, I think what really happened was the opposite. That the so-called plans division of the CIA, which later got a more honest name, the operations division of the CIA, has totally overshadowed the significance of the analysts in the Department of Intelligence, which is, of course, what the CIA was set up to do. That's why Truman complained in 1963. He said the CIA... I never wanted this. He said, I wanted the CIA to provide intelligence. And there was substance to his complaint. But unfortunately, it was done while he was president, whether or not he was fully aware of what was happening.
The U.S. Office of Policy Coordination, the OPC, which you've been talking about, later folded into the CIA's Directorate of Operations.
First plans and then later operations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They didn't want OPC. You had no idea it was in operations. Department of Plans doesn't sound like they're doing operation, but yeah, they were doing operation. Finally, they called a spade and spade called it the Department of Operations.
Well, according to your book, American War Machine, the OPC contributed to Gladio networks abroad, such as the Grey Wolves in Turkey, which you write about. The OPC was giving covert support to organized drug traffickers globally, constituting a global financial complex of hot money uniting business, government, and finance, according to your book. And you've mentioned that the OPC was run by Alan Dulles. Also, Frank Wisner was involved, wasn't he?
Actually, Frank Wisner ran OPC. The OPC was a very complicated situation. It was supposed to be under the scrutiny of the State Department, the Defense Department, and the CIA without being part of any one of them. Frank Wisner ran it, and Alan Dulles was the man in the CIA who was responsible for coordinating it, and later when it came into CIA, he, I believe, was in charge. But it was remarkably independent. It had a huge budget. And yes, Al McCoy did a good job on listing some of the countries. OPC was involved with drug traffickers in Marseille and Corsican drug traffickers. It was involved with drug traffickers in Italy. It was the Grey Wolves. I'm not quite sure when that began, whether it was OPC or CIA, but the Grey Wolves were drug traffickers. And then, of course, the most systematic thing of all was in Southeast Asia, centered in Thailand, but involving Burma and Laos. And it was a huge operation there because that was building up the drug trade. I mean, the people in Europe were just distributors of drugs. But I think, I'm doing this from memory, I have it in the book, but I think that production of drugs for the global market in Thailand, in the Golden Triangle, that's to say Southeast Asia, it was insignificant in world trafficking until the CIA went there, and every country, it multiplied by a factor of about 10. Some people say as much as 1,200 tons of opium a year were being grown at the end, and it had been really much less than that, I think under 100 tons when the CIA began it in about 1950.
And, of course, you mentioned Paul Helliwell, who was part of the Office of Policy Coordination, the OPC. Do you consider Helliwell to be the principal architect of the post-war CIA drug connection?
I do consider him to be an important post-war architect, absolutely. As to whether or not he was formally in the OPC, there's some difference of opinion about that, and it's hard to pin down. What we do know for a certainty was that he was a lawyer in Miami, and as a lawyer in Miami, he helped set up proprietary companies for the CIA, which then became the infrastructure of the drug traffic. There were at least three, but I'll name two. The first one was something called CAT Inc., CAT Inc., which was short for Civil Air Transport. They took over Claire Chennault's airline and created a base for it in Thailand. And those supplied the planes that flew arms into Burma to support the Kuomintang KMT armies there that initially were supposed to fight Communist China, but turned out to be totally incapable of even fighting local militias in China. So they just settled down and ran the drug traffic in Burma. And then there was another company in Bangkok, Sea Supply Inc., SEA Supply, short for Southeast Asia Supply Inc. And Sea Supply would buy the arms and things which the army in Burma needed. Now, this is being somewhat misunderstood, even by myself at one stage. When it became obvious that these KMT armies in Burma were not doing anything to fight China, but were growing drugs, and when the Burmese government complained about this, America then officially broke its connections with these armies. But it was an interesting thing about the planes in CAT Inc. By the way, CAT Inc. became Air America. Everybody, I think, knew about it in the end as a CIA airline. But the planes were 40% owned by the CIA. they were 60% owned by rich people in Taiwan. So you had a regular situation where the CIA would hire the planes for a flight of arms into Burma, but the planes wouldn't come out of Burma empty. They would come out of Burma loaded with opium, but that wasn't a CIA flight. That was a flight for the Chinese in Taiwan. So you had this going on for 10 years, and meanwhile, we had the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in those days, run by a man called Answinger, and a lot of his top people were also CIA people, like George White, the veterans of OSS. And time after time, they would say that Communist China was bringing drugs into America. Well, Chinese were bringing drugs into America, but they were Taiwanese who were being very assiduously protected by the U.S. government. And in more than one book, I've given an example of a big drug bust that involved people right here in San Francisco. And the top man of all, according to records that were later put into the congressional record from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, the top man was not arrested. He was allowed to fly out of Hong Kong. And where did he fly to? He flew to Taiwan, because that's where it was all being masterminded. And it was something that became the World Anti-Communist League. The top people doing the planning were also in the Anti-Communist League, and they were lined up with other drug traffickers in other countries. Latin America became a big example. So that all of this was a series of things which the CIA or OPC would help kick off at the beginning, but it would become autonomous, independent. The CIA wanted it that way. They didn't want to be running the drug business directly. Their charter was to set up operations that were covert, that were plausibly deniable. And they created, in the fashion I've just described, they created a plausibly deniable relationship to the drug trade in Southeast Asia. They weren't profiting from it directly. They could say, no, we're not in the drug business. That was true, but they were responsible for the drug business being there, and they used it most conspicuously in Laos, where, as I say, they had a Hmong army of thousands of people. And no, they weren't paying the Hmong. The drug traffic was paying the Hmong. But the Hmong wouldn't have had air bases, and they wouldn't have had airplanes if it hadn't been for the CIA.
Was the World Anti-Communist League, which you've mentioned, actually a cover for global drug trafficking?
No, I think they were sincerely anti-communist. Many of them, not all of them by any means, but many of them, were involved in drug trafficking. And again, an example I gave was this prince, I think his name was Sopsaysana, from Laos, and he was the official Laotian delegate to the World Anti-Communist League, and he was also picked up at Orly Airport in Paris. The year, I think, was 1971, and he had a suitcase with $6.5 million worth of heroin in his suitcase. The relationship isn't always as conspicuous as that particular one, but in my bookshelves behind me here, I have the proceedings of the, actually in those days it was the Asian People's Anti-Communist League. It was only in 1966 it became the World Anti-Communist League. And I just check off all the names on the side who are either involved in drug trafficking or involved in very dirty covert operations in their country, or maybe both together.
Serge Peter Carlo, the executive officer for the official history of the OSS in World War II, who produced the two-volume war report of the OSS under high-level OSS and CIA officer Kermit Roosevelt, went on record that the still-censored section under Unorthodox Methods of Acquisition of Special Funds in Volume 1 is about the OSS's use of narcotics, drug trafficking, to fund covert operations during World War II, and that this continued after the end of the war under the OSS's successor, the CIA. In your research into narcotics drug trafficking to fund U.S. covert operations, have you come across any other sources that this goes back to the OSS in World War II?
Yes, it's a long time since I've looked at that material, but my memory of it is that actually it was Axis funds generally, some of which were narcotics and some of which weren't. Something that's not very well understood, even though a lot has been written about it, is what happened in Italy in 1945 when Alan Dulles negotiated against his government's instructions, because America agreed at Yalta in 1944 that there would be unconditional surrender. And meanwhile, Alan Dulles had developed links to people in the SS, and especially a General Wolf. And this is called Operation Sunrise, and the kind of sort of a normal version of it for American consumption is that it was to negotiate a surrender of the troops in Italy, which finally happened 1 week before the generals surrendered. And that's true as far as it goes, but it's the tip of the iceberg, because what Wolf was in charge of, he was in charge of the Ostmark, and the Ostmark is drawn by Hitler, involved Italy and the South Tyrol and Tyrol, and essentially a big chunk, if not all, of Austria. And the SS, in the last weeks of the war, moved all their gold into Austria. They robbed the biggest bank in Berlin and took all its gold down to Austria. And the Croatians, who had their own, because they were a Nazi ally in the war, and they moved their gold into Austria. And I believe that what that censored part of the report says, that the OSS got involved in something called Operation Safe Haven, which was to find out where all the gold was. I think what it, in effect, was a cover for taking over that gold. And we do know that the very first CIA operation, this is even before OPC is being created in June of 48, the spring of 48, the Italian election, was paid for with captured Axis resources. Whether that was narcotics or not, I don't know. But we do have it from official sources that it was captured Axis resources. So that was a source of funds for the CIA then, and a precedent then for using funds from the Marshall Plan and all the other successive things that happened later.
Right, including perhaps Operation Gladio and all of the covert ops that spun off from that.
Yes. I wouldn't be able to draw you a chart showing where Gladio fit in, but yes, obviously it was a covert operation, and at a time when we had funds to draw on for such operations. And then, of course, they would also, in the case of Turkey, at least become largely self-sustaining, because the Grey Wolves, I don't want you to think that Grey Wolves was Gladio. Grey Wolves was a drug trafficking right-wing organization that Gladio recruited Gladio people from. But the funding was taken care of because they were involved in drug trafficking. By the way, one of those people, this man Adjes, the man who was then recruited by somebody, there's debate by whom, but recruited by somebody to shoot at the Pope, Pope John Paul, that's attacked in 1981. And immediately the CIA in Washington and the Reagan administration would say, aha, the wicked hand of the Kremlin behind this. The man who did all that propaganda was chiefly a man called Paul Hensa, who had been the CIA man in Ankara, where they had set up this Gladio thing going on the thing. So it was a false flag operation, I think. And then you see, as you trace what happened to Aja through the years, as he was convicted and put in prison and people would go talk to him, you do see Western intelligence connections. You don't see communist connections.
Peter, earlier you mentioned Corsican drug traffickers and the end of World War II. Could you talk a bit about, back to Paul Helliwell, I believe he was involved in this, James Angleton, of course, of the CIA, the Corsican drug traffickers, Marseille, and the Lansky-Luciano global drug connection. Could you talk a bit about that?
Okay, well, first of all, let's fix where Paul Helliwell was. During the war, he was in Kunming in Yunnan, China, which was so much at the heart of Chinese drug trafficking that that station actually paid their operatives in opium. That was a standard way. And a number of very interesting people, not just Helliwell, came out of that station. When he came to America, he set up a couple of banks in Florida, and his partner was a man called E.P. Barry. And the interesting thing about E.P. Barry is that he had been with OSS counterintelligence in Austria, working, according to a book I found, that he was working on Operation Safe Haven. So I've always wondered if some of that Axis money didn't end up in Paul Helliwell's banks in Florida. What we do know is that one of his banks, at least, was doing business with a bank in Switzerland, which was a bank used by Meyer Lansky. So you can talk about a Helliwell-Lansky connection, and you can certainly say that the drugs coming, they, of course, didn't come initially from France and Italy. They came through France and Italy, handled by the Italian mafia and the Corsican mafia, and really should say Sicilian mafia. Luciano, there's still a debate whether he was involved in the drug trade. I'm one of those who believe that he was. But certainly those mafias were involved, and when you trace the banking, the banking is a system of Meyer Lansky banks that Paul Helliwell's banks interacted with, and eventually the CIA itself helped set up a bank in the Bahamas called Castle Bank. This is a bit later now, in the 1960s, but it's essentially set up to serve the needs of the CIA and to serve the needs of organized crime, and that the people on the America, on the mafia side, goes directly to organized crime figures in Chicago. I have a whole chapter in American War Machine about this, and there are even some CIA documents referring to an operation, and then it's all blacked out, so I could just reproduce the blacking out. We don't know the name of the operation, but the CIA knew they were in bed with these mafioso types. And you mentioned James Angleton. Now, he was definitely in a position because he was in Rome right after the war and had to deal with all the various OSS assets there. And that included both right-wing fascists like Prince Borghese, who later on staged a coup against the Italian government, but also, and here it gets very shadowy, but Americans were not only involved with the Italian mafia, but we imported American mafia. You see, Mussolini was a totalitarian ruler. There were very few organized resistance groups to him. One group he could never control was the mafia. He had reduced its power, but he had never been able to illuminate it. You get this weird situation after World War II where an American from Tammany Hall by the name of Poletti, Charles Poletti, is running the Allied military government in Italy, that's AMGOP, and he's got Vito Genovese, who's a major American mafia figure and drug trafficker, in his office. That's that's fictionalized as Catch-22, but it was based on a real situation. William Donovan went to Italy in 1948. This is maybe before OPC was in business, and seems to have been involved, this is according to an Italian book, but a good one, in setting up American mafia figures who helped. There was a risk of a communist takeover in Sicily, and that was dealt with quite major massacre. So it's very difficult to give you a tidy picture of how Angleton relates to all that, because, of course, it's all covert. But there is a milieu that Angleton is part of in Sicily, and it relates to all of these things relate because ultimately they're all being supervised by OPC. And if Halliwell isn't exactly in OPC, he may have been. He certainly was doing business with OPC at a very high level. I mean, he was central to their planning. And for the CIA later on, you know, the Wall Street Journal in 1980, they did a story about the Castle Bank, and they mentioned Halliwell. And they said that Halliwell was the paymaster for the Bay of Pigs operations. Well, I've worked with thousands of CIA documents, and I've only encountered Paul Halliwell's name exactly once. And that one time was in a list of documents which were to be hidden when they were hunting for the family jewels in the CIA. They were supposed to come up with a list of all the things the CIA had done which legally they should not have done. And Halliwell is not in the family jewels list because we know from one document that he was in a list of documents that were to be hidden in Theodore Shackley's safe at the time this search was going on. I conclude from that I think he was not the paymaster for the Bay of Pigs. That's a regular sort of bureaucratic job, which I think was done by someone at a much lower level. I think Halliwell was at a higher level, a real deep state level, and that the Wall Street Journal, I hate to criticize them, but I think he would probably had something to do with the Bay of Pigs, but I don't think he was the paymaster.
Before we leave the subject of Paul Halliwell, and of course you mentioned his banks in Florida, what can you tell us about the International Credit Bank in Switzerland that, according to your book, was founded by an Israeli gunrunner and Edmund de Rothschild?
Yes, with a man called Rosenthal. It a bit misrepresents him to describe those aspects of him. He was an important, before there was an Israel, there was a Mossad trying to get Israel started. And Mossad was both a formal organization and a loose set of connections. And Tibor Rosenbaum I don't have my book in front of me. He set up that bank as part of that loose connection. And Edmond de Rothschild, who was the sort of black sheep of the Rothschild family, was involved. Their main goal was not to be in drugs or anything like that. Their goal was to have a state of Israel. But because they had limited resources, they, like every other government, the United States, France, Britain, they got involved in drug trafficking too, yes. But that's not how I would characterize them. I may have said that in my book, but that's not how I would characterize them.
And just as an interesting aside, when I was reading a little bit about James Jesus Angleton of the CIA counterintelligence on Wikipedia, it happened to mention that he actually retired in Israel.
He had very good Israeli connections. Some people say it came from when he was in Vienna in the 1930s as a student, not in the government yet. Other people say it really happened in Rome after the war. Because it's an interesting thing that I think part of the deal between Dulles and General Wolf was that certain people who were SS would be allowed to escape out of Europe and go to Latin America. The Vatican, by the way, was in on those negotiations, and the Vatican helped set up what they called the Rat Line, which was a series of safe houses whereby people could get out of Germany and get down to Italy and eventually go either to the Middle East or to Argentina. Most of them went to Argentina initially. one of the people involved in the negotiations, a man called Walter Rauff, R-A-U-F-F, Rauff, he personally went to Latin America, ended up in Chile, and may have been a factor in the 1973 overthrow of Allende. In 1973, he certainly ran a kind of Nazi colony in Chile, which was a source of right-wing activity. Among the people who were involved in this rat line were the Israelis, because a lot of Jews wanted to get out of Germany, too. And there was a kind of understanding, a deal, where Jews wouldn't complain about the rat line getting the Nazis out because they could get Jews out the same way. And there is, I think, a memoir or two, at least one memoir, where a man says that it was very odd to see that somebody had been at his a Jew, saying there was somebody from his concentration camp who had been one of his oppressors for the Nazis, and now both he and his Nazi oppressor were escaping from Europe through the same rat line. So that's how, for sure, Angleton got to know Israelis in the 1945-46-47 period, because the CIA was also very involved. The remnants of the SS, the CIA-OPC, the Vatican, Mossad, everybody was using that rat line.
Now, with regard to the rat line, and I know there's a book out, a pretty new book, on the rat line, who, in your opinion, was running the rat line? Was that an American operation, or?
No, this is where you have to start thinking deep politics here. You see, everybody was running it, nobody was running it. It's like the OPC, three different agencies were running it, meant it was autonomous. The rat line, if any one individual was running it, it would have been a cardinal in one of the colleges in Vatican City. But he was a Croat. Was he doing it for the Pope, or was he doing it for the remnants of the Croatian government? Really almost impossible to say. It was very much, I would say, in the end, autonomous. It would be wrong to categorize it as being American or Vatican or Nazi. In the world of deep politics, you can't bring a kind of a structural framework to say, okay, which box will we put this in? Was it American or was it Vatican? Everything becomes much more, I used to call it a milieu. It's more structured than a milieu, but it's far less structured than, say, a government agency or something like that. And it takes a lot of training to think in terms of this deep state with its deep politics, and I'm still learning. I don't consider myself a real authority. I just consider myself somebody who's been poking around there for a long time, more and more astonished by what I learn there.
Well, with regard to the global drug trade, is there evidence that secret rendition flights to snatch and deliver victims to black sites such as Bagram were more importantly cover for the pickup and delivery of drugs by the U.S. government? Is there evidence of that?
There is evidence that when the CIA had to fly people secretly, they weren't going to book a ticket on American Airlines or British Airways, they would turn to people who were in the covert flying business. Most of those people are arms traffickers or drug traffickers, and usually the two together, because there's a natural symbiosis in a trade where you fly arms into a disputed area, and drugs are grown in disputed areas, so you fly drugs out. And that's why when, for example, we started supporting a covert operation in Afghanistan in 1979, mostly 1980, it was mostly trucking, but the trucks that took the arms in were the trucks that took the drugs out. And that's why fighting there made it so much easier to export the drugs that you were growing. And that's when Afghanistan, for the first time, became a major drug exporting area. I think in terms of America, Reagan's own official records showed that America had almost no drugs from the Golden Crescent in 1979, and that 60% of American heroin came from the Golden Crescent in 1980. That gives you an idea of how important covert operations are to drug trafficking. So the CIA, in rendition, they have to turn that asset to planes. Well, they hire the plane to do something. But the plane belongs to a man who's either in the arms trade or in the drug trade or in both. So it's very likely that a plane that's involved in a rendition flight may also have something else on board at the same time. The CIA hasn't decreed that. It's not a CIA decision. But you're hiring an airplane over which you don't have complete control. So you get an overlap of operations on that level, too. I have seen the claim that rendition flights involved drug planes, and I don't know anything more than what I've seen that point.
You write in your most recent article that 70% of the $60 billion that the government spends on intelligence goes to private intelligence contractors, Booz Allen Hamilton, SAIC, etc., that the private intel contractors constitute a revolving door employment with government, and that Booz Allen is majority owned by none other than the Carlyle Group.
That's true. Yes, all of that is true. And Booz Allen, Allen Dulles became director of the CIA in 1953. Eisenhower took over. And that was a green light to the OPC people because Truman didn't like covert operations and had tried to restrain it. And 1953 is the year that Booz Allen Hamilton, well, in those days it was Booz Allen and Hamilton, and they, until then, had been a management consulting firm working with U.S. corporations in America. But 1953 is the year that the CIA goes big time in covert operations abroad, and in three countries in particular, the Philippines, General Lansdale, Egypt, and Iran. And lo and behold, Booz Allen and Hamilton goes big time abroad in 1953, and the first three countries are the Philippines, Egypt, and Iran. And somebody like Miles Copeland, who helps Kermit Roosevelt, whom you mentioned earlier, overthrow the Shah of Iran in 1953, then leaves the CIA. Miles Copeland goes to Booz Allen Hamilton. And then after a while, he's working for Booz Allen Hamilton, which has contracts with oil companies around the world. He then takes a, quote, leave of absence, which I think is not a very real leave of absence from either agency, and goes to work for a man called Adnan Khashoggi, who becomes the richest man in the world from his profits from arms sales to Saudi Arabia, some of which profits are then kicked back into CIA operations, and some of them are kicked back into Khashoggi's personal budget. The richest man in the world starts funding American politicians, and that's probably a good way to end it because we see how the deep state is controlling the politicians rather than the politicians controlling the deep state.
Great stuff by Bonnie Faulkner and Peter Dale Scott there, working outside the economic system, documenting deep state malfeasance. We're doing more or less the same thing in text form. At Wikispooks, we had a record number of editors editing on a single day last week, and another editor joined just yesterday, so it's encouraging stuff. I do think it is getting manifestly harder to keep this stuff secret, and that encourages me that people will decide that they better not do things that they don't want other people to find out about. If you'd like to download this show or any others, you can do so from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.